is the author of many interesting books. Susan, just introduce yourself a bit, talk about some of your books.
Sure. So I'm an investigative journalist. I worked for Fox News Channel, CBS News, Voice of America. I was speechwriter for Michael Howard, who was Shadow Foreign Secretary. I was also speechwriter for the Korean ambassador, Sung Chul-young. And I earned my master's degree from the University of Essex. And while I was a postgraduate, I founded the European Review, which became the departmental publication for the Center for European Studies. And that journal allowed me to kind of edit manuscripts that were focusing on European economic, political, strategic integration, and also afforded me the opportunity to cover like historic events that were, pertinent to European integration, like the Council of Europe summit in Madrid that launched the euro. So.
Well, what's interesting to me, Susan, is that your credentials, your pedigree, you are classically what we might euphemistically describe as a deep stater, by
That
your background. And yet your books are, I mean, you are on fire in terms of blowing the whistle on what we euphemistically call the deep state. Now, I mean that term in the very broadest sense. We have a lot of movable parts there all around the world, but there are certain telltale signs, even though it's generally quite secretive, that we can point to that indicate a deep state agenda. We could talk about a lot of things going on right now in politics, including this idea of an electronic passport to prove you've had a vaccine, which I think is the end of freedom if we ever get to that.
Agreed.
And I want to get into some of that as the program goes forward. But I brought you on today because of an article you wrote about Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist. It's kind of a complex subject. There are a lot of names involved of people that we don't know, but your research uncovered some very interesting things about the scandal that enveloped Jack Abramoff back in the early part, about 2005, 2004, during the Bush administration. He had been a lobbyist representing Native American tribes and representing the North Mariana Islands. And he ended up going to prison, and he wrote a book about it, which I actually read, and I interviewed Jack Abramoff. And his book exposes the underbelly of all of the lobbying endeavors and how the thing that I took away from it, and you can certainly elaborate, is that much of our laws, our regulations are actually written by these sort of code writers, these unelected attorneys and activists who salt these things into the law. I mean, you don't even see them there. And most congressmen, when they promote a bill, they don't even know what it's in it. And Abramoff gave an extreme example. He shows, you could see a bill that's like 300 pages, and then all of a sudden you see this little squiggly sign in the middle of a sentence that says, opposite something, and you link into that, which links you to another thing, which links you to another thing, and eventually you get to something that gives like a big piece of money to somebody or does something to remove a certain element of our freedom. It gives a favor. And then it's so complex that we can't possibly know the kinds of laws that are being made by our representatives, not to mention the laws that are being made by unelected agencies. And a transfer of power to people like people like Dr. Fauci. I don't know, somebody not elected who gets to make all kinds of incredible laws. But so give us a quick overview of what Jack Abramoff was doing, what he represented, and based on your research, and then we'll get into the case.
Absolutely. So I actually wrote a book on Jack Abramoff called Lynched. It was based upon 6 years of research, and I was able to exhume thousands of pages of documentation. I interviewed hundreds of sources or were familiar with his case. So what you were talking about in terms of inserting different language into bills, that is very commonplace. And what I was discovering while working on the case is that every minute of a congressperson's day is accounted for by some special interest, a speech they make, a nod, an acknowledgement before Congress. Every minute is accounted for and paid for. And much of those special interests are hidden from the public unless you really follow the money and figure out why are they saying that, who stands to benefit, and who might have given them money that would, lead them to do what they did. So in terms of Jack Abramoff, he was the most prodigious lobbyist on Capitol Hill at the time, worked for the Bush administration. And he was sort of an outsider, even though he became the ultimate insider. He entered Indian country, which is what I found out later, is the area where the deep state was able to establish a presence and then project itself throughout the country and ultimately establish this kind of deep state around the whole nation. Mm-hmm. The Indian tribes were self-contained government-subsidized markets. So they would have numerous, products and services that were guaranteed. They had a customer base, tribal members. They didn't have to monitor the prices. They could set whatever they wanted, and the taxpayer would be left on the hook. They also established casinos. In most cases, the casinos were subsidized by taxpayers, and they were typically the result of settlements, that were pulled together to establish a casino. These were allowed to develop to give the Indian tribes a sense of sovereignty and to enable them to become financially independent. But instead, they became more dependent. They continued to rely upon the government, demand more money, and that money ended up subsidizing big business. In fact, in one case, I was able to trace where money from tribal casinos was subsidizing the mergers and acquisitions departments of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. Mm-hmm. So you can see that, Jack Abramoff had gone into the establishment. He had entered a market which was rigged for lobbyists to enrich themselves, to enrich special interests. And then he kind of took it over because he was better at the game than they were. So they ended up aligning against him in order to force him out because he was, he posed too great of competition for them.
So we're talking about an unholy collusion between corrupt Native American governments and certain high level business entities.
Correct.
Who were working together. Now, that's not to say that all Native American governments are corrupt. It's only certain ones. Mm-hmm. And that also the entire system of recognizing Native American governments, it actually goes back to the administration of Ulysses Grant, mm-hmm. where I think that it was Russell Means who was the head of the Lakota tribe during the Wounded Knee incident in 1973, mm-hmm. who testified before Congress and said, if you want to see what socialism looks like, take a look at the Native American life and the governments. These are dependents. They've been made dependent on the state through money and through administration. And that the state, that being the US government, not state governments pretty much, corrupted these governments both literally and also culturally by, selling cheap booze and, getting people dependent and addicted. And they used Native American people for various social experiments that have continued right up till this day. And most Native Americans have no idea how much duped they've been by this establishment. So here we have now Jack Abramoff hired by Native American tribes because he's a very good lobbyist. Mm-hmm. And he begins to blow the whistle on some of these activities. So what happens?
Okay, yes. So what you've said is absolutely correct. And just to elaborate a little further, they were established by the Rockefeller family, which kind of mapped out the country. They were, Indians were corralled in land rich in minerals and natural resources. And then those companies extracted the resources to enrich themselves. And actually a plan from the very beginning to project socialism into, to make those tribes socialist, as you said. Right. Right. So Jack Abramoff He was representing the tribal interest. Like there was always a tribal interest and then an interest that was fictitious. Like these were individuals who were posing as Indians, were trying to steal their inheritance. So one by one, Jack Abramoff was usurped, or he was removing lobbyists who were representing the corrupt tribal interest. He was representing the interests of the genuine Native American people. He was accused of intervening in tribal elections, but the truth was that there was no intervention. The tribe, the tribes confirmed that. But he did make his case to the Indian tribes. He told them what he could do for them. They voted en masse to get him elected because they thought he is our only chance. Once he got, they were able to get their own people into power. They then elected to hire him. And Jack Abramoff lobbied for appropriations for the Indians, which he delivered far in excess of what they paid him. He also protected their market share. And he said, well, if you have a casino, a portion of the proceeds are taken the form of per capita payment. So that's what, the income that Indians have to live on. Now, the typical lobbyist was not concerned with their market share. They wanted money from as many clients as possible. Right. They allowed casinos to proliferate. He was, Abramoff was effectively preventing the casinos from developing. He eventually tripped when he entered the Florida market. And at that time, the Seminole Tribe of Florida was attempting to acquire a casino. It had made a few efforts at taking customers on cruises to nowhere. The reason for that is that the state of Florida did not allow gaming in the state, on the mainland. So they tried to go into the seas, were quite corrupt in the matter. So their main competition was Sun Cruise. Now they had made numerous efforts to remove Gus Bolas from the market, to shut him down. He was facing a lot of regulatory issues, some of which were driven by lobbyists. And I guess eventually, as Gus Bolas was being pushed out, Jack Abramoff was approached at Preston Gates. Do you want to purchase this Sun Cruise? He agreed to do so. And I guess that set off a chain of events, which, eventually felt his career. But he, depending on which way you'd like to go, I'd be happy to discuss what happened.
Now, Sun Cruise was a private company. It was not a Native American company. They would Correct. Take people offshore so they could gamble. And a lot of retirees would go, and they would go out near the Bahamas and whatnot. And by the way, that's a phenomenon that's in other states as well. Like, for example, there are Mississippi cruises that do this. There's even here in Massachusetts or in Maine, there's mm-hmm. a cruise that goes from Portland, Maine to Halifax that does it. As soon as they're off of American waters, they open the casino. it is a big business. And mm-hmm. how is then the Sun business connected, the fall of Bolas, who is the owner of Sun business, how is that connected? What does that have to do with Jack Abramoff stepping in and the political trouble that he then got in?
Okay, so the establishment was invested in the Indian tribes. There was so much money to be made. The rival Seminole Tribe of Florida was, I believe it was the first tribe in the nation to acquire a Las Vegas style casino or a casino type of machine. Okay. So they had a lot vested in the success of the Seminole Tribe. There were different bills passed, one by Frank Wolf of Virginia, who tried to pass legislation that would curtail the cruises to nowhere. There were also efforts by lobbyists. One was Walter Brown, who had spearheaded the Monte Carlo. He represented Hive Marine and was eventually fell into trouble for the dual representation of both union members and then the governments, and lobbying for the governments which employed those individuals. So there was a lot of corruption within the game boating industry. So Gus Bolas was like really the sole game in town. And the Seminoles were trying to figure out how they could kind of shut him down. At the time, I guess Donald Trump, our former president, he had retained Greenberg Traurig as lobbyist to help the Seminole tribe acquire a casino. One of his former executives, Jim Allen, was a CEO of gaming for that tribe. And so they were lobbying aggressively. They had plans on acquiring the Hard Rock franchise, which was, you know, a massive undertaking, but they didn't have the money to do it. The only way they
Hard Rock, you're talking about the Hard Rock cafes around the country?
Hard Rock cafes, correct.
Now, what did Trump, did Donald Trump, as a business, when he was a private businessman, he wanted to have a financial share in the Seminole business? Was that it?
I believe so. I think his view was that he was unable to compete against the Indians since they were given a lot of tax advantages. And so he was given an opportunity, I believe, which might have been made possible by the Clintons to get involved in the tribal gaming.
And this was at a time when he was running casinos in Atlantic City.
Correct.
Okay. So we're talking about the whole business. So then Abramoff jumps in. How did Abramoff then run afoul of the government? When did he fall out of favor and why?
That's a good question. He ended up partnering with a fellow by the name of Adam Kadan, who was a bankrupt disbarred attorney. Abramoff was fairly shrewd. You know, he had good judgment overall. And had he known about Kadan's background, he never would have gone into business with him. But Adam Kadan represented that he had sold his mattress business for a large sum of money. He knew Jack from their College Republican days, and he approached him with an opportunity to, you know, go into business together. So Jack made an agreement that they would split the closing costs, mm-hmm. but that he would handle regulatory matters and the governmental aspects and business development while Kadan raised the money. Now, of course, as a bankrupt disbarred attorney, Kadan had few options in which to earn money. So he reached out to the competition, which was the Seminole Tribe of Florida. And you know that because he was the counsel to the St. Martin's Casino at a time when the Seminoles were investing there. Also the bank at the center of the alleged fraud within the deal, Foothill Wells Fargo, was represented by the same law firm which represented the tribe's financial advisor. So this was the tribe that they constructed the loan in such a way whereby Kadan would be able to acquire the fleet with no money down. They would create a fake wire transfer to lend the impression to the secondary lender that the money had been received, and then Bolas, who was the seller who wanted to retain a stake in the business. He was going to keep a stake, and then Adam would pay him what he was due after closing. But what Adam did is that after closing, he devalued the fleet post-sale inspection by the amount in which he owed Bolas, and then pushed Bolas out. So Bolas was there. You know, he lost his business. It was sold for no money, and he was part of the fraud. So there was very little he could do to retain any interest in the business. So there were a lot of articles written about the controversies and the rivalries between these two men, which were making a lot of headlines. Mm-hmm. And then out of the blue, Bolas is shot. He was and killed gangland style. The mobsters who were associated with that murder were caterers on Kadan's with Sun Cruz, tied to the Gotti and Gambino families. They were mobsters from New York. And around this time, there was a lot of mob activity associated with the Seminole tribe. It was reported in the media. It was reported in gambling disclosure reports. And even one of the security guards who was who was warning law enforcement about this activity, he was fired from his job. But The Seminoles had a financial stake with the Broward County Sheriff's Department through like a security contract that they held, and the Broward County ended up investigating the Bolas murder. And I was able to talk to one of the attorneys of the mobsters, and he said that the Seminoles were always suspected of being responsible for that murder, but the investigation never went in that direction. But somehow after the murder, there was a lot of controversy in which Abramoff was accused of being guilty by association of having been so greedy that he stole this business from poor Gus Bolas and then and then ended up murdering him, to get away with it. But it was, this was conceived by the Seminole tribe.
Sounds like the Seminoles had developed an unholy alliance with the New York mob.
They did. A lot of the Indian tribes actually do have some type of mob activity in them.
Right, and this is obviously a scandal that is much bigger than we can even know. And of course, it makes sense that this would be the case because, Native American governments have a little bit more, they have immunity to a certain degree, and they have a little bit more regulatory freedom to do things like gambling casinos and other activities that might not be, conventionally acceptable and a much looser regulation. So if there's going to be big money involved, you're going to have some organized crime and you're going to have some corruption in politics, like possibly in Broward County and elsewhere. And obviously, if something like that becomes too entrenched, it only gets worse and it becomes a little bit more part of the firmament of the establishment in a given area. That's what seems like what happened here.
That's correct. And I think even Donald Trump said at the time, he said if the public became aware of the extent of mob activity within Indian country, this would be one of the biggest scandals of the nation.
And it's always the case. I mean, this isn't some tin hat conspiracy theory. I mean, you always have an underlying, right under the surface, a level of corruption because power is corrupting.
Correct.
And as Lord Acton said, an absolute power corrupts absolutely. I mean, if you have power, there's always going to be people who are going to want to take advantage of that. And that's why we have a system, at least on the surface, of justice and a separation of powers. So you can have some honest people competing with others and balancing power as a way to get to, to try to get to the bottom of it. So Abramoff then takes the fall. There's I don't know exactly what he was convicted of, but there was a big, big story that they showed him being taken out of his car and being, there he is with his yarmulke, and everything. And he's an Orthodox Jew and they're carrying and carting him off to prison. How did it get to that point?
Well, originally Jack Abramoff had planned to sue Adam Kadan and to recover his assets, but after the scandal, he was recruited by Greenberg Traurig, which was the Seminoles' attorney, and the Greenberg Traurig had a vast influence with the Department of Justice since it had represented Bush Cheney during the 2000 election, probably for the electoral votes of Florida. So they had a vast influence with the Department of Justice, ensuring that any investigation into Abramoff would be controlled by them. So the Sun Cruise debacle wasn't enough to really do much with him because he was the innocent party. The bank, Bolas, and Kadan were the culprits. The Seminole lobbyists actually conceived of a scheme in which to entrap him in Indian country. And the way that they did this is they could tell that he charged generally far more than they did. He was earning this maybe 150 to 200 to 200,000 per month compared to their 20,000 per month per tribe. So they conceived a narrative that was based upon the Washington Post, Susan Schmidt, an article that she'd written on the Cheyenne Arapaho tribe, in which political consultants on Capitol Hill had overcharged the tribe, resulting in the devastation for those Indians. So they assumed that, well, if Abramoff is charging that much, a similar dynamic could be at play, and at least it would be plausible. So they first approached the Louisiana Coushatta dissidents within those tribes. And the dissidents leaked the information to the local media that in which they alleged that Jack Abramoff's prices are so extensive that we cannot afford to pay our healthcare, our medical expenses, anything. And the allegations were quickly retracted. But then, you know, because they were simply untrue, the paperwork contradicted it, and the reporter who covered that particular tribe was very honest. So he looked into it further. He found they were untrue, and he wrote the retraction. But then these allegations began to reoccur throughout all of Indian country through the local media, and the tribal councils were refuting them, but the refutations were ignored. Instead, what happened is that Susan Schmidt, who was working with the lobbyists of the Seminole tribe, took the original allegations, and then she reported it in the Washington Post. That those stories were then given to a PR firm, which blanketed the entire nation with the false allegations. Mm-hmm. And then Congressman Frank Wolf, who had been watching Abramoff because he was upset over the Sun Cruise matter, he wanted to shut down Sun Cruise. He recommended to John McCain, whose fundraisers were losing business to Abramoff, that, you know, why don't you hold hearings and investigate him? Mm-hmm. McCain happily complied, and then hearings were held based upon the false allegations.
Right. And then that led to a conviction. And I think he spent at least a year or two in prison.
Yes, he did.
Where do things stand today in terms of all of these controversies?
In terms of Abramoff, you mean?
Yes. Or Abramoff and the Seminoles and all of it.
Okay. It's kind of a little complicated. I'll try to go into it. During the hearings, of course, the witnesses reiterated the false allegations because they were being coached by said lobbyists. Mm-hmm. And as you said that, after the hearings, the dissidents who participated in those hearings became tribal council members. Right. And the members who hired Abramoff were pushed out. So within the Louisiana Coushatta, there was actually an Israeli connection, which is little known. Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, who presided over the Abramoff hearings, mm-hmm. Who also attempted to acquire one of Abramoff's clients after he left Congress, he had signed a, I believe it was some type of a bill that agreed to move the U.S. embassy in Israel over to Jerusalem, and then a firm, I think it was Holland and Knight, was working became the first firm to move over to Israel, to Jerusalem, and they were laying the foundations for American corporations to kind of move over to Israel, especially tech companies. Mm-hmm. So one of the gentleman's name was David Gorin. He worked for Holland and Knight. Somehow his firm he became counsel to a group called Mainnet. Mainnet was an Israeli technological firm it was an early technological firm. The tribe was directed to invest around $30 million in this company. It ended up losing all of the money and that deal went bust. But there was a lot of essentially this firm embezzled $30 million from the tribe. Within the Saginaw Chippewa Indian tribe, the Hard Rock Cafe and the Seminoles attempted to establish a Hard Rock business within Michigan. Mm-hmm. With this deal, they were going to have the Saginaw Chippewa Indian tribe, which had reached $1 billion portfolio status, mm-hmm. Invest in the business, and then they were going to share the proceeds. The only thing that the Hard Rock was going to bring to the table was the brand name. But somehow through this engagement, the Saginaw Chippewa Indian tribe lost $1 billion. The money vanished into thin air.
And who knows where that turned out.
Who knows where the but it is interesting that the Hard Rock brand was purchased for $1 billion. I don't know if that covered the expenses, but it's interesting.
I think Michigan has an extensive network of casinos, Native American casinos.
That's correct. So while Abramoff had had protected the tribe's market share, I think there may have been a 3 or 4 casinos in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Now there are over 26, about 26 in county.
Incredible. All right. So Susan, you are the author of many books, Susan Bradford. You could look them up on Amazon. I want to ask you, not to shift gears too much here, in brief about one of your more recent books, The Shadow Dragon, the inside story behind Donald Trump's struggle to derail the deep state agenda. I think that conventional wisdom holds that that's exactly what Trump tried to do. That's exactly why they are trying to take him out and have taken him out, quite frankly. I don't want to go too far into this because this is YouTube, so we have to be careful. But yeah, I mean, he expressed it best in his inaugural address, where he said, look, I'm here to oppose both Democrat and Republican corrupt operatives who have been in power for a long time and who are all about power in Washington, power in the hands of this growing oligarch. And I intend to return power to the people. Right. And Trump was very independent. He didn't accept money from the big donors. He didn't need, he wasn't like the kind of compromised president like somebody like, frankly, Biden is, or like Obama was. You know, I think in Obama's case, he was an egomaniac, and they, typical of a lot of people, they basically massage his ego and give him this advantage, and then he's owned by them. Or somebody like Biden, who is so compromised because of using his public office to enrich himself and his family for so many decades, and kickbacks and all the rest of the stuff. Trump didn't have any of that because Trump already was a multi-million, frankly, a billionaire. He was already famous. He already had this incredible life. He didn't need it. And he felt like he wanted to do something to give something back to his country. I really think evidence suggests that. I certainly believe that. And so he wasn't controlled. And he was thus seen as an enemy of this growing oligarchic deep state that I think has been controlling this country in probably since the Wilson administration, when things I think really took off, probably to an extent going all the way back, but that's when I think things really started to centralize. And that's why they tried to take him out literally from the minute he stepped off the elevator. So talk a little bit about your book about Trump's taking on the deep state.
Okay.
I know it's a big one, but.
No, it's a big one. Okay, so to kind of conclude, where we've just gone.
Thank you.
Trump, to his credit, I guess, was pushed out of a lot of the deals within Indian country. He ended up being pushed out of the Hard Rock cafes. He was not part of that corruption. There was corruption within the tribe. He was not part of it, just to be clear about that.
Yes.
So within the book on China, the China agenda stems, I guess officially it got underway at the end of the World War II. At Yalta, an agreement was made between Churchill, FDR, and Stalin that they were going to elevate communist China to ruler of the New World Order and reduce the United States to the largest welfare state. So through successive administrations, that's exactly what happened. And there were a number of complicit politicians, the Clintons and Bushes were key to this end. And I think in the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton had intended to collapse the United States under the euro, or not the euro, but the yuan. By this point, the United States was the leading international currency, but in order for this new world order to take place, they'd have to have one global currency. And the currencies are, I guess, exchanged in a basket of currencies. So that's in part why Hillary referred to the nationalists and patriots as a basket of deplorables. She was referring mm-hmm. to the basket of currencies that she was going to bring in. And so just before, like about 1 month before before the election, the yuan was introduced into the basket of currencies, anticipating a Clinton win. Thankfully, you know, thanks to God and other, you know, circumstances, and possibly through, you know, a large amount of popular support for Trump, Trump prevailed over her and derailed that agenda. So he began to move towards towards nationalism, putting America first, and kind of derailing this this agenda that has been really decades in the making.
Yes. And I think that for whatever reason, the establishment was caught sleeping. They didn't really expect it. I mean, I think they were expecting Hillary to win by a landslide. And in fact, they felt that probably, and again, let's be careful, this is YouTube, I don't want to get shut down. They felt that, let's just say, it was predetermined. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that it just didn't fall up that way. So they made sure that they would get it back 4 years later. I don't want to go too far into this. Again, I can get into this on my non-YouTube stations, but in the present atmosphere we're in right now, you're not free to discuss some things that can be proven. Mm-hmm. However, they have been successful in, I don't know if I'm allowed to use the word coup, so I won't, mm-hmm. but put it this way, the present regime is very much a continuation of the policies that you're mentioning with regard to China. Right. In fact, the present president, I don't think this is too controversial, has accepted huge amounts of money from China in the form of his family members, his brothers, his son, anyone else. And that, you know, it's all full steam ahead in this China agenda that I think you accurately have given some historical context to, going back to Yalta, and given the deliberate handing over of China to Mao Zedong in 1948. So now that we're at that point again, we're, you know, it's terrifying, but where are we now? I mean, is this, I think that one of the keys to understanding what's coming down the pike, and again, I want to be careful here for the YouTube censors, is the business of this electronic passport. This is what they're doing in communist China. They have every citizen, in fact, it's been pretty much acknowledged at this point that you get a score, you get a, like a social score in China, where if you don't have a high enough score, you may not be able to buy food. I mean, you can't leave your community. You have no rights. You have no freedoms. And that they keep the score through the smartphone. And that George Gilder, who's one of America's most respected intellectuals, who spent several years in China, I think under the Bush administration, he's written about this. He's talked about this, that he says that this is an agenda that is coming to the United States, and Google and the big tech are going to be implementing it. Now, I think that that's what we're seeing now. I think that's why you have, like, for example, my understanding is that there are, the it works in three parts. There's the E, there's the S, and there's the G. And that's how businesses now are scored. I don't know so much individuals. The E stands for environment. The S stands for, quote, social justice. In other words, socialism. And the G stands for governance. And you have to have a high enough score in all of those areas in order to function as a business, in order to get, you know, certain things to happen online. And this is why, for example, big companies like Coca-Cola and Delta Airlines, they decided to boycott the state of Georgia for passing conventional laws that protected the elections in the future and reformed some improprieties that had occurred in the last election. All of a sudden, they're boycotting Georgia. And the reason they are is because this social score system was telling them that they had to, in order to function, in order to continue as they were. Do you have any information about that?
So this whole agenda actually was put in place with the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. I know that we discussed last time, you know, that the monarchy is controlled by the Rothschilds. So with her coronation, they coronated silent weapons for quiet wars. And that was an agenda whereby they planned to track and trace every single individual and to ration what, you know, their energy usage. They consider us assets, you know, not living human beings. We're assets in their corporations, since all the country's a corporation, or at least was until recently. The states are corporations. So we're mere assets who use and generate revenue for them. The social credit score was created, I believe, by Eric Schmidt of Google. I believe that they were trying to, he was working with Jared Kushner in the White House to develop the RDIF chip, which could be implemented in the, or put into the vaccine to track us. So I think that that is part of their agenda, that they want to be able to account for every person. They're also trying to create techno cities that will corral the people into these technological, like small gulags type of situations, where we will have a minimal footprint. We will have enough freedom and resources to for basic sustenance and to perform whatever services the cabal wants us to. We'll have a livable income. And then if our social credit score is somehow not desirable, you know, we will lose privileges. So mm-hmm. it's very Pavlovian. You know, you can boost your credit score, get your rewards, and you can, you know, do things that they do not approve of in terms of how whatever values that they've set up, and you can lose those privileges. So it's a control mechanism, as you know, you've seen.
And by the way, the business of the computer chip implanted, you know, this was something that people, you know, Alex Jones talked about. Everyone said, oh, he's crazy, you know, tin hat, nutcase. It's turned out that now, just a couple of weeks ago, 60 Minutes did a segment. I mean, you can't get more establishment than them, where they showed that, sure enough, the Pentagon, using the end of the DARPA program, which was established by Eisenhower, is working on a chip. And they had this scientist, Halperin, who looked like a cult follower with his eyes bugging out, ooh, you know, saying and holding it up for the camera and saying, yes, we are working on this chip. What it's going to do is it's going to regulate everyone's body once it's implemented to tell us whether or not they have the virus. Like, we need to have a chip to let us know this, you know? I mean, and so, yeah, this is exactly what's coming down the pike. And people are being conditioned to accept the development of this electronic passport, which is going to have everything they need to know about you on it, which is going to track your whereabouts. It's going to track your conversations. It is going to be the end of freedom. That'll be it. If we accept the electronic passport, you know, we really have to draw the line on that. You know, we cannot go down that road. We must not accept it under any circumstances.
I would agree with it. And it is entirely being pushed by the Rothschilds. The chip was developed, I believe, with Kinetech. It's a defense contracting firm in England, which the Queen holds the golden share. So the Rothschilds control the Queen. It's their company, their technology, their agenda that they are implementing. And I believe that during the Obama administration, the Defense Department determined that they were going to apply military technology to the civilian sector. So the chip was one of those. It was going to be used against the enemies of the country, while the enemies were identified as the patriots, because those are the people who are just,
The deplorables.
The deplorables.
All of us. Mm-hmm. You know, so I want to wrap it up, but I just want to say one other reflection that this is nothing that I've heard anyone say. It's my own thinking. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about how local police departments have been under assault by radical thug, you know, the street, what Lenin called the shock troops, mm-hmm. Antifa, BLM. I want to be careful here, because this is YouTube and we know the people there are, like, you know, are sympathetic. But, you know, it's these thugs who last summer were looting Black businesses and burning Black neighborhoods and killing Black people in inner cities. And the result has been that people are leaving police departments in the big cities. Correct. In New York in particular, they're leaving in droves. People are not becoming policemen. Now, maybe I'm just reading into this, but I recall that Obama, when he was running for office in 2008, delivered a speech in Colorado Springs where he talked about a national police force. This is, of course, what they did in National Socialist Germany. It was called the Gestapo. You didn't have local policing anymore. It was all run out of the federal government of Germany. And that he felt that this would be the future of policing. I wonder if this isn't part of this agenda to demonize local policemen. And you have radicals, you know, falling into this and useful idiots saying, oh, the police are just killing people, you know, innocent people on the street. And then it becomes a national hysteria, like a kind of an implant, like it's and somebody, all of a sudden everyone's stimulated to hate policemen. And naturally, the result is a lot of young people who might otherwise have gotten into policing are choosing not to, you know, for good reason. I mean, it's not only a dangerous job, but you have everybody against you. So do you think that I'm just all wet on this, or am I seeing something that might be coming down the pike?
I think you're seeing something that is coming down the pike because, you know, we discussed earlier last time, the Rothschilds were behind Nazi Germany, and there's a formula that they follow. So they're implementing a kind of a Nazi Germany techniques here. And, you know, you're talking like Black Lives Matter, BLM. They're sponsored by corporate America and the major banks and by these globalist churches. So, you know, the problem is being created by the Rothschilds, and the solution is what, you know, what they had in Nazi Germany. So I think you're absolutely correct.
And I just want to be on the record that I would dispute your mentioning the Rothschilds as the name.
Okay.
Only because we don't really know, you know, let's not forget that the elites and the deep state, they operate in secret, they always have. And so as such, they're secret. We don't know who's behind it. And so I don't know I think it might be for me a little too easy to say, well, it's the Rothschilds or it's someone else.
I think they're at the pinnacle. They're at the pinnacle.
Okay, you're entitled to that opinion. I don't, my answer is that I don't know. I'm agnostic on that question because I don't know. But I think we do know an agenda that we can identify regardless of who's behind it. And that's kind of my approach to this. And I think that on that, we completely do agree. So Susan, let our listeners here and our viewers know where they can get your excellent books and information about your work.
Thank you very much. My website is susanbradford.org, and that contains my books, my background, it links to Amazon. So you're welcome to get purchase my books there if you're interested. And I also have the means to contact me if any of you have any questions I can answer for you.
Susan, you know, you're a great guest, and I hope to have you on regularly. I mean, I'm developing several regular programs, and I hope to develop one with you as well. So I want to thank you for joining me today. We'll do it again soon. And have a great afternoon. Thank you.
You do the same. Thank you.
All right, Susan. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right.